I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is education and parenting expert Alfie Cohn. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Alfie Cohn. The conventional wisdom is that helicopter parents are everywhere, refusing to let their children learn from failure, indulging, or coddling instead of setting limits. The result? We're raising a generation of narcissists. Grades are inflated and trophies are handed out too readily. But are these criticisms true? What underlying values, as well as assumptions about child development, human behavior, and motivation, have led even political progressives to sound like social conservatives when the conversation turns to children? Alfie Cohn is here tonight to challenge media-stoked fears and what he says are misconceptions about kids, what they're like, and how they're raised. Alfie Cohn is the author of 13 books on education, parenting, and human behavior, including Punished by Rewards, Unconditional Parenting, and most recently, The Myth of the Spoiled Child. Please join me in welcoming Alfie Cohn to the JCCSF.
Thank you. Thanks so much for coming out tonight. I'm delighted to see all of you. I have written in the past about issues having to do with what classrooms can look like and how different that often is from what they do look like. And I also wrote a book almost 10 years ago for parents about how we might raise children. But most recently, I found myself increasingly intrigued by beliefs about parenting and children and where those beliefs come from, and whether they are based on defensible values and good research. And I often find myself fascinated and irked when I find that practices and beliefs pull in one direction and what we actually know to be true pulls in another. And so that whenever I feel sufficiently irked, I know a new book is coming on. So some of you may know a linguist at Berkeley named George Lakoff, who has written about metaphors and also consults with political parties about the way issues are framed politically. And in one of his books called Moral Politics, he opens with an interesting anecdote about how he was chatting with a friend of his in his garden. And he asked his friend, "Do you think there is a single question we could ask people such that their answer would predict their viewpoint on a range of different political issues, from abortion to gun control to foreign policy to environment?" And his friend said, "Sure. Just ask them, when your baby cries, do you pick him up?" Now, Lakoff uses that to spin off a fascinating model where he distinguishes between people who have what he calls a strict father morality versus those who have what he calls a nurturing parent morality. And it's an intriguing and internally coherent distinction, even if he doesn't really have a lot of good evidence. And I read all 400 pages of the book, and I'm still not clear whether he's making an empirical hypothesis or simply spinning out an elaborate metaphor. I found it intriguing until I noticed one problem. Lots of people in our country who are reliably liberal on a range of political and social issues, once the conversation turns to children, sound like they're on Fox News. And I've been struggling to figure out why that is. Because the political beliefs and cultural beliefs about what children are like and how they're raised has become a kind of mainstream wisdom that is deeply conservative and accepted on faith even by people who are not conservative on other issues. So, for example, we hear constantly that children today are spoiled, entitled, and narcissistic. And not just little kids or teenagers, but millennials in their 20s. They have been given too much latitude, and their parents have been indulgent and are permissive to a fault, unable or unwilling to set limits or to discipline in the way these kids need, with the result that these kids think everyone owes them a living and that they are precious and special, and boy, are they in for a rude shock when they get out into the unforgiving real world. These views are heard at dinner parties, and they are heard, again, as I say, even from people who are quite liberal on other issues. They are repeated endlessly in a media echo chamber, and in fact, these are virtually the only positions you hear on these issues from the mainstream prestige magazines, like The Atlantic and The New Yorker, and the New York Times Magazine, not to mention syndicated columnists and so on. If somebody is going to write an article in any of those publications about self-esteem and children, it will always say that children have too much self-esteem. They don't experience enough failure, which is actually good for them. They need more grit and self-discipline. They are indulged and entitled. And somehow at the same time that kids have been raised by these supposedly permissive parents who let them do whatever they want, the parents at the same time are being accused of being helicopter parents who are too involved in their children's lives. Somehow nobody seems to notice that these are very different, if not contradictory, attacks on parents, because permissiveness could be thought of as a kind of underparenting, and yet they're guilty of overparenting at the same time. As long as we're critical from a right-wing perspective and critical of children across the board, people nod along saying, yeah, it's a lot worse than it used to be when I was a kid, that's for sure, without noticing the contradiction or saying, do you have any data to support this? Because I notice that all you do are recycle the same anecdotes and quote a small circle of other journalists and therapists who agree with the author. Where's the proof? Well, I went looking for this proof on all of these different claims. First, do we have any evidence that parents today are permissive in America, assuming we could agree on what that means? And the answer is, to the best of my knowledge, and I've looked pretty hard, there has been no nationally representative survey data that will allow us to conclude virtually anything about parenting styles and how many parents are permissive versus punitive versus neither permissive nor punitive, a third possibility that is almost entirely excluded, a problematic feature in its own right. Much less do we have any evidence that would allow us to say that parents today are more permissive than parents were X years ago. There's not even a shred of data to support those beliefs. Just the tendency for us all to complain that things used to be better in the old days when parents laid down the law. One question is, do we know that there is that kind of difference now versus then? The answer is no. But the second possibility The second implicit premise here is that it would be better for parents to control their children in those old-fashioned ways. The value judgment built into what's known as the good old days is as troubling as the empirical belief that those days were different than they are now. This is what you find reliably, sometimes it seems without exception. You read enough of these books, which I had to read quite a number of to prepare for my own, enough of these articles about spoiled children in the New Yorker and the Atlantic and so on, you can be forgiven for assuming that a single person wrote every single one of these books and articles. There was an article in the Atlantic that said, children have always looked after their own pleasure, but it has never been as serious as it is now. Never before have we seen a situation where parents don't teach values in a serious way, and all we have on the part of children is a cult du moi. It's all about the self. Did you see that article in the Atlantic? If you didn't, it may be because it was published in 1911. This is what I had great fun doing in the book. I quoted a lot of articles and books and blogs from recent years, all of which contrast things being awful these days with the way they were a generation ago. And then I back up a generation and find examples of exactly the same claims that in turn contrast with a generation before that, and so on. If you can look back to the days of Hesiod, the Greek poet, thousands of years ago, talking about this generation going to hell. It's a cutesy, but at the same time, substantively powerful rebuttal. Because if you make the claim that kids today are entitled and narcissistic and their parents don't set limits and don't let their kids fail, and it's never been as bad as it is now, and I show you your grandparents saying exactly the same thing, it ought to make you sit down and shut up. But of course, it never has that effect when you do this. For example, I love playing this game. I love quoting faculty members at Harvard, excoriating a policy of grade inflation where kids today expect to get an A for almost any crap they turn in and then say, voila, 1894. Harvard's Committee on the Standard grades, letter grades, were less than 10 years old, and already we heard from the people from the grouchy, wistful school, you know, belly aching about kids today getting A's too easily. When you put this into historical perspective, you begin to realize just how little substance underlies the folks across the political spectrum making these claims today. Now, there was no evidence whatsoever to suggest that kids today are any worse than they were, any more spoiled or narcissistic or thinking too well of themselves, until a few years ago when there's one conservative psychologist who has become a sort of one-person ditto machine turning off studies. That's an outdated reference, if ever there was one. A woman by the name of Jean Twenge, who has done one study after another, all of them painting young people in the worst possible light and claiming that survey data show that kids today are much more narcissistic and have higher self-esteem and only think of themselves and so on. If you've seen any article in the newspaper in the last 10 years making that claim, it's always a Twenge study. And so I was really interested to consult other people in the field of data analysis and social psychology who attempted and failed to replicate her results and found one problem after another with her methodology to the point that I think any fair-minded person would see, and you can tell this just from reading her books, which are polemics more than careful analyses of data, that it is ideology, not an open mind to what science shows, driving her claims to see kids today. And by the way, one of the interesting things about her data is that she will compare now to then in haphazard and inconsistent ways then could be 10 years ago or 30 years ago. Kids could be 12-year-olds or 30-year-olds lumped together as if it were a single cohort. Whatever allows her to cherry-pick the data to show that kids today are worse than they ever have been. So if you set aside Twenge's claims, there's nothing. There are no data to support the idea that young people today are more spoiled or self-centered or more narcissistic and so on than kids used to be. Now, if you really want to be a stickler about it, you would have to show A, that parents are more permissive, B, that kids are more spoiled, and C, that A caused B. And no one has even tried to draw a causal link. So all of these claims say more about the people who make them and their view of the world than they do about parents or kids and the reality they're professing to describe. We have a tougher burden. And the same happens when we talk about claims of overparenting. Overparenting is a bad thing by definition. The prefix over means too much. But the question is, how much is too much? And it quickly becomes clear that it's not just an amount of parenting that might become problematic, but rather the question is, what kind of parenting is going on? And what are the motives for certain kinds of parenting? Is it possible to do too much for your child? I think that depends on what your outcome variable is. What's your criterion for deciding what is the healthy or unhealthy outcome? What are the reasons that parents get involved to a particular extent or in a particular way? I will concede that there are some parents who need their children to need them. And that troubles me. When the way and the amount in which they become involved in their kids' lives is driven not by what their children need, but by their own psychological issues, where they become upset by their children's signs of independence and require their children to be dependent on them. I need them to need me. That is probably problematic. But it's not so easy to say that a whole rash of parents are simply too involved in their children's lives without looking at the motives for that and how it affects the kids themselves. There's an enormous variation in terms of what kids need from us, depending on the circumstances, their personalities, their ages, and much else. A sweeping across the board, parents ought to step back and do less, seems to me informed by ideology more than an understanding of child development. And some of it is particularly driven by an American commitment to individualism. Have you heard it said, for example, that the parent's main objective or goal should be to equip kids with what they need so they can make it on their own? They're emerging adults. Let them emerge already. Why are they still living with me? Why are they still texting me? Their job is to separate and individuate and fly the nest. Well, that's not the way people look at it all over the world. And in fact, it represents a viewpoint of extreme self-sufficiency that is far more popular with men than with women, with professional classes than with working classes, in the Western world than in the Eastern world, in industrialized societies than in non-industrialized societies. In many subcultures in this country, there is more emphasis on interdependence than independence, or at least an attempt to find a balance that works.
You're listening to education and parenting expert Alfie Cohn on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So when you hear people talk about kids who are teenagers or in their 20s who are not self-sufficient, and there's something wrong with that, take a step back to ask how culturally limited is the worldview that assumes that our job is to make them fly and work on their own as soon as they're able to. We see some of this even with little kids. You know, honey, you're old enough to use a big boy fork now. I'm not going to carry you when you can walk. The assumption is if you can possibly do it on your own, you should do it on your own. And I invite you to query why we believe that's true, rather than just to take it for granted. There's a difference between autonomy in the psychological sense, which means a sense of integrated commitment to one's actions and values, a kind of psychological health. And on the other hand, individualism. There are some young people who are very individualistic and not at all connected to their parents, and they're not very autonomous, psychologically speaking. Some of them may be internally motivated without being intrinsically motivated. Have you met teenagers who are pushing, 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 who are desperate to get ahead, who are workaholics in training, who are joyless but getting into expensive colleges and pleasing their parents? These kids no longer have adults standing over them with carrots and sticks to goad them into doing something. They have, to use the psychoanalytic word, introjected, which means swallowed whole, that sense of compulsion. They are not joyful. They are not healthy. But boy, are they successful in conventional senses of the word, with the grades and test scores and college acceptances, and some of them are psychological basket cases, and the parents are pleased instead of worried. Conversely, there are some young people who are quite autonomous, psychologically speaking, and intrinsically motivated to do what they do, but they text their parents constantly and want to see them a lot and are closely connected and not particularly independent. Let's not confuse the two. Until a few years ago, there was no research to speak of about helicopter parenting of college-aged kids. Every single article you would read in a magazine deploring helicopter parenting cited not a single study, but that didn't stop the writers from inveighing against it. Now we do have a bunch of studies on helicopter parenting of that age, and the studies show the following. One, it's not nearly as widespread as anyone thought, including people who are critics of it. The research that goes looking at their colleges for kids who are not just talking to their parents a lot, but their parents are getting very involved in their lives, interfering in their behalf with the dean, or micromanaging Junior's love life from a few hundred miles away, turns out to be the exception rather than the rule when you start collecting survey data. The second thing is that it turns out that even the kind or level of helicopter parenting that you or I might find a little troubling is correlated with a more successful, happy, academically engaged college experience. This came out in a national study a few years ago that floored even the people conducting the study, who found that the helicopter parented kids were those who seemed to be much more engaged with the learning and scoring higher on a variety of measures of psychological health and well-being. But then when you looked more carefully, you found a third interesting bit of research finding, and it was this: not all young people are alike. And so a single sweeping statement about helicopter parenting bad turns out not to pay attention to differences in class, race, gender, and particularly whether these young people were the first in their families to go to college. Because those for whom that was true, it turned out, often needed more parental support, and I don't just mean financial support, than they were getting. When they were tossed into elite liberal arts colleges, where the assumption is you're on your own now, that was a very poor match for what they needed and from the kinds of cultures from which they had emerged. So when you start applying some basic common sense and skepticism about the data on which these claims sit, you begin to realize that what we read in all of these magazines is actually quite problematic and very rarely supported. But beyond looking at claims about permissive parents and spoiled kids or over-parenting, what's really interesting is to find claims about how kids today get stuff too easily. And so you find these claims made constantly that kids today get praised, or they get stickers for every little thing. Everybody gets an A because of the scourge, nay, the epidemic of grade inflation. And they get trophies just for showing up. I Googled that phrase, trophies just for showing up. Hundreds of thousands of hits just for that phrase, let alone for all the other ways of putting it. This has become the sort of go-to notion, to the point that online discussions about almost anything having to do with parenting and education, if you look at the discussion sections, the online comments, somebody is bound to bring this up. The idea that kids today get which what they mean is, and I don't even know, I couldn't find out, I don't think anybody else has found out how common it actually is. But it's taken on a life of its own as a kind of a trope, a narrative that says that kids get these little thanks for playing trophies, even if they weren't on the conquerors. This is responded to by people, not with a reasoned critique. When kids get these trophies, if they didn't win, here's what we find happens to them. Any such claim would have to depend on the assumption that the kid thought she won and had no idea that the trophy was just thanks for playing. Because if the kid knows that it's just thanks for playing, how could it possibly have a detrimental effect? Nobody bothers to say that. And of course, I've never met a kid who trophy? I guess I won after all. But there, people respond to this phenomenon, often inflating its pervasiveness in their minds, mostly with sneering ridicule and sarcasm, you know, about, oh, I guess we have to protect our precious snowflakes, you know, with their delicate self-esteem. You know, I mean, when you think about the extent to which phrases like that are used in this sneering, facetious way, you really want to press these people and ask, just what do you think of children and what they need? What exactly is driving? What exactly is driving this rage that people are sent into when they imagine the possibility that somewhere some kid is getting a trophy or a thank you without having earned it. Unlike the good old days when you had to be a conquering hero to get a piece of tin. So I began to, first what I did is I looked at it in its own right to think, they're making an empirical claim. They're saying, if you give kids A's or praise, or you give them trophies or stickers or something else that we don't think they've earned, that bad things will happen as a result. And the usual claim is they'll think they're special or more successful than they are, and then they're going to crash into Earth when they realize that life is actually unpleasant and no one gives a crap, and that they're failures. It's an empirical hypothesis. Is there any evidence to support it? And the answer is, not only is there no evidence to support this basic claim, the evidence overwhelmingly supports the opposite view in terms of how children should be raised. Not that we should give out trophies, which I personally think is silly. But I would like to question trophies from the opposite direction. These are claims that are being made about motivation. And I broke it down into three claims, each of which admits of good theory and research. And so the first claim is that people need to get rewards when they're successful, or they won't be motivated to get off their butts. And not only must they get rewards when they're successful, they must go conspicuously unrewarded when they're not successful. Even something that looks like a trophy must not be given to them, lest they then realize that they got a reward anyway, and thus would have no reason to try. So as it happens, I wrote a whole book about this years ago called Punished by Rewards. What I found in looking through hundreds of studies is that not only do rewards prove unnecessary for both children and adults to do the most amazing things, but that when people are doing things to get rewards, they tend to lose interest in whatever they had to do to get them, and tend to do them more poorly. So, for example, if I gave all of you a puzzle to solve, and I divided you into two groups, group one, you just get this puzzle. Here, see if you can figure this out. Group two gets the same puzzle, but you're told there will be a reward if you're successful at solving the puzzle. Every single study that has looked at this has found that on average, the people without the reward are more successful at solving the puzzle. And it's not just true of puzzles. It's true for a range of tasks. The only variation is that the more ingenuity or creativity that's required, the more higher level the task, the more rewards kill excellence. It's astonishing. This has been found across cultures, across genders, across ages. Part of the reason, though not the only one, is that rewards undermine interest. If I say to my kid, all right, honey, do all the math problems in your homework and the extra credit problem, and you can watch an extra hour of TV, I have taught my kid a very simple lesson. Two words. Math sucks. Because he has inferred, this must be something I wouldn't want to do, otherwise they wouldn't have to bribe me to do it. This is true contrary to the conventional wisdom in American workplaces that tend to resemble a Skinner box with a parking lot, that are driven by merit pay, pay for performance, bonuses and the like. I've been studying this for more than 25 years. To the best of my knowledge, no controlled scientific study has ever found a long-term enhancement in the quality of work as a result of any kind of incentive or reward. I've been My challenge to people has been for years, and I've actually been invited, odd though it may seem, to speak to Fortune 500 companies about how incentive plans kill excellence. I've been asking people to show me an example of anything. You can make people do more stuff faster for a short time. If it was about how many envelopes can you lick in an hour, you know, and I made it worth your while by saying, if you lick enough of them, I'll give you $1,000. Yeah. But when we start talking about the quality of work and start talking about long-term, rewards aren't just ineffective, they're counterproductive. And this is true not only of work in the workplace and learning in classrooms, it's also true of activities and values. For example, two studies have found that children who are rewarded or praised tend to be less generous than their peers. And the effect is most pronounced if they're rewarded or praised for being generous. Good job. I really like the way you shared your brownie with Diane. You're such a good helper. Good job. Good job. Good job. Good job. Good job. Good job. She just became a little more selfish as a result of that interaction, according to good research. This is not something I thought of in the shower this morning. First, because rewards, like punishments, are ways of controlling people. And even very short people figure that out on some level. Rewards, including verbal rewards, are just sugar-coated control that sap people of that sense of autonomy. Notice, though, how importantly different this critique of praise is from the mainstream conservative critique that says the problem is we're overindulging kids by giving them too much praise or giving it too easily. I'm saying the problem with praise isn't that we're indulging kids, it's that we're controlling kids exactly as we do with punishment. It's a doing-to style of interaction, and it turns out not only to be bad for our relationship and for kids' psychological health, it lowers performance. So that was the first point. But then I noticed that there was a second claim being made, especially around issues like trophies, where it's not just that rewards are necessary, but that competition is necessary, which is to say, we don't just want kids to succeed, and we have to reward them when they do. We have to set up arrangements where they succeed at someone else's expense. And so, critical to the notion of motivation here is the idea that we want to make sure that kids are winners, and that in order to be successful, they will triumph over other people. Well, turns out there's a whole bunch of research on that too, which I don't have time to expand on at great length or possibly even at all, that shows that competition is the most destructive of all the rewards. The only thing worse than a reward is an award. You know, the difference is, you know, an award is a reward that has been made artificially scarce. So if I get it, you can't. And now we're set against each other. And that turns out to be counterproductive for everyone. Everyone loses in a race to win. It's bad enough if we give kids grades in school because now they're focused not on the learning, but on the grade. That's why the best schools do not give grades, and the best teachers, even in traditional schools, refuse to give grades as much as they possibly can. And the best parents never look at report cards with their kids. They ask their kids questions about what they're learning, never about how well the teacher thinks they're learning it, at least not if they want their kids to be lifelong learners. The research consistently shows that when you get kids focused on grades, three things tend to happen reliably. They lose interest in the learning, they think in a more superficial way, shallower way, because now they're not asking, how do we know that's true? Or doesn't that contradict what we were talking about last week? Instead, they ask, do we have to know this? And the third effect that grades have is it leads kids to pick the easiest possible task when you give them a choice, like the shortest book. Not because they're lazy, but because they're rational. Well, duh. When you said you wanted to see a better report card, of course I picked the easiest thing. Because the easier the task, the better the chance I can give you what you seem to want, which is a good report card. That's the opposite of intellectual risk-taking.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features education and parenting expert Alfie Cohn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And the third hypothesis that I found buried in this, got to reward kids if you want them to be successful and make sure they're not rewarded if they aren't. You got to reward them in particular for beating other people because that's what leads to excellence. And third, you got to make sure they fail a lot because they need lots of experience with failure so they can pick themselves up and dust themselves off and say, by gosh, I'm going to try even harder next time, which is more of a utopian fantasy on the right wing than any progressive assumption about education or kids' motivation I've ever heard. Some people are resilient and pick themselves up. But research in psychology consistently shows that all else being equal, the most logical and common result of failure for a kid is to think of him or herself as someone who fails and thus becomes less likely to succeed next time. So let me just mention one study that's been replicated a number of times. Kids are given a task that they cannot do. They're not told that. They're just given a task that's deliberately impossible. Then they're given a task that is possible. And what tends to happen is most kids do far more poorly on the task that was possible after having failed because of what they have inferred about their own capability and their desire for challenge. The idea that kids are going to fail later on and there's going to be a lot of unpleasantness in the world, therefore, the best thing to do for little kids is to make sure they're miserable now to prepare them for it, is ludicrous when you put it so baldly, but not that different from a very seriously accepted way of raising and teaching kids. For example, no research has ever found any benefit to homework before kids are in high school. Even in high school, newer research is raising questions about it even there. The idea that kids have to work a second shift after spending all day in school has never produced any benefit for kids younger than about 15. And when you show this research to educators and parents of younger children, their response is BGUDI, which is my silly acronym for better get used to it. Because people are going to make you miserable with homework later. We've got to start making you miserable right now. It's basically the same rationale that's used to justify making little kids compete or giving them grades or any number of other things, including a deliberate let's make kids benefit from skinning their knees because a little pain will do them good. This deeply right-wing view, utterly at variance with everything we know about child development, is a huge hit among parenting authors and education policymakers who seem to overlook the fact that we don't best prepare kids for a difficult or challenging life by making their childhoods difficult and challenging. Quite the opposite is true. So I look at this research that shows that rewards are neither necessary or desirable, that competition is even worse, and that Bhagudi doesn't make sense and failure is overrated, and I show the evidence to people who clamor about, oh my God, the trophies and blah, blah, blah. Now, do you change your mind? And you know the experience I have? You can judge for yourself whether it makes sense to you. What I tend to hear from people when I show them the empirical research that shows their hypotheses are wrong is they say, in effect, but they lost! They're not supposed to get a trophy! And that's when you realize that the whole empirical hypothesis thing was just basically a sham. And it's deeply right-wing ideology feeding into this. I don't care that they're all at Stanford. They're not supposed to get A's. If too many kids are getting A's, it means that we don't have high standards. Even though these are all the creme de la creme kids who were there to begin with. And you realize that for each of those claims, there is a shadow value. Underneath, to work backwards, underneath the claim that kids need to experience more failure and frustration to cope with difficult circumstances is the belief that kids ought to experience deprivation. Things shouldn't be too easy for them. Underneath the claim that competition promotes excellence, for which there isn't a shred of evidence, even for adults, let alone kids, is the belief that excellence, by definition, is a scarce commodity. Even when they get to Stanford, we have to sort them all over again because there must always be losers. Otherwise, we're sanctioning mediocrity. And the one that really has a claim on me and that I'd love to talk about for much longer, but I can't, is underneath the belief that you must reward people when they do something effectively and make sure they're not rewarded when they don't, is a belief in conditionality. Everything in life is a commodity to be earned. Even expressions of acceptance from your parents, even the way you feel about yourself. Hence, the deeply conservative war on inflated self-esteem, where kids are said to think too well of themselves. And you know what the research on self-esteem actually shows? Not just that high self-esteem tends to be better than lower, but that what's more important than high self-esteem is unconditional self-esteem. In other words, even when kids screw up or fall short, the best predictor of mental health and a happy life is a core of faith in themselves that they are still good, valuable people. And unconditional self-esteem is exactly what the conservatives hate even more than high self-esteem. The idea that you don't have to earn that good feeling. Because all of this turns out to lie at the intersection of economics and theology. But it's being passed off to us as psychology. And it's a very bad psychology. And where does unconditional self-esteem come from? I don't mean grandiose, you know, I can do anything, I'm perfect. That actually becomes more of a reaction to people who are actually conditional. I'm only good when I'm smart, funny, thin, popular. That's the kiss of death. I'm a good person only when dot, 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 when it's conditional. And the best way to help kids have that healthy, unconditional sense of belief in themselves is for us as parents and even as teachers to accept them for who they are, not for what they do. That doesn't mean we can't help them to rethink stuff they do that's problematic, but it means that we have to give them the message always that our attention, our approval, our acknowledgement, our care is something they never need to earn. And so I had this sort of ongoing little revelation as I wrote this latest book that all of the flack and hostility I've experienced in the writing I've done on related topics over the last couple of decades is a result of a rarely examined set of beliefs about what goodness is about motivation, about child development, about human nature. And all of it is presenting itself as an empirically informed critique of what parents are doing wrong and what's wrong with our kids today. So the more skeptical you are of those claims you hear, and the more you dig into the almost non-existent basis for those claims, the more you look at the values and what we want for our kids in the long run, the more it becomes a tragedy that the worst and least supported and supportable assumptions about children have not only been widely accepted among social conservatives, but that almost everyone has become a social conservative in this culture without even recognizing that. Our kids deserve better. I have lots more to say about how I think we should raise and how we should teach kids, but the point tonight is simply to raise the question that beliefs about children and parenting need to be unpacked before we can do what's right by our kids. Thank you. You have a question?
Thank you. So questions, we'll start right here in the front.
This is a short question because I'm a teacher and I'm thinking about Arne Duncan, and if you've ever met him and you could talk to him about the things that you're talking about. So just curious about it. But I'm also curious about education and particularly with middle school children, what you would say about that particular phase of life and having the kind of engagement and care and attention to who they truly are faced with what we see in our industrial educational system.
Have I ever talked to Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education? No. I have gradually learned that things tend to work out better when I speak only where I've been invited. I have much to say, obviously, about the corporate-styled, test-driven, privatization-furthering kind of school reform we see in front of us. A few decades ago, there was a genuine attempt to reform what we did with kids who were about 12, 13, 14 years old. We took one look at the junior high school model and said, this is bad for kids intellectually, let alone emotionally. That we need to create a middle school model, not just to change the grade configuration from 7-8-9 to 6-7-8, but rather we have to make sure that this is a place that supports kids in their psychological, artistic, physical, social, and academic growth. And due to the pressure to impose specific one-size-fits-all curriculum standards and substitute high test scores for meaningful outcome measures of intellectual growth with a bribe and threat top-down approach that was accelerated under the Bush administration and then accelerated at warp drive under the Obama administration beyond the wildest dreams of what the Bush people were able to do. As a result of that, we have basically lost most of this, so that now middle schools have this feel of open wide, here come the facts you're going to be expected to know for the test and expected to know in high school. And we've lost any progress for that age group. Not only for that age group, today the average kindergarten looks like a really bad first grade, representing the same, not only acceleration, but in my view, developmentally inappropriate view. And what's so interesting about all of this is that it's done in a way that represents the same kind of values and this could have been part two of this talk, if there's one other issue where even people who are liberal on other issues sound like conservatives besides parenting, it's education. So, for example, without exception, every single liberal columnist for the New York Times, every single editorial page in any newspaper across the country that takes a generally liberal position sounds like the Daily Oklahoman and is literally indistinguishable from the most right-wing Republican on education issues with the same rhetoric about tougher standards, raise the bar, global competitiveness in the 21st century, and the need to assess and hold high standards. Why is it that in education and in parenting, a progressive vision politically and culturally is missing? It's like the culture wars where children are concerned, except no one's fighting on the other side.
My question is about the self-esteem. What can I do to empower their self-esteem? Do I just love them, give them food and hugs and kisses? Can you give us something a little more to hold on to?
Okay, kids learn to feel good about themselves by knowing that no matter how they screw up, your love is never going to be turned down and dimmed. That's the first thing. They know that there may be problems that we have to solve together, but I never have to worry that I have failed to earn your love because of something I've done. And they get it from your tone of voice, your facial expression, your body posture, and the things you say. Never, never, never is that care. If the care has to be earned, it's not worthy of being called care. Second, if you want kids to feel good about themselves and empowered, you don't marinate them in praise. I mean, that's basically a judgment. And kids don't need to be judged. A positive judgment can be just as undermining as a negative judgment. If you want to give kids one thing that will help them feel empowered in a real way, bring them in on making decisions. Kids learn how to make good choices by making choices, not by following directions. And no patronizing pat on the head can ever substitute for that sense of, we're going to solve this together, and I'm going to try to make some decisions myself with your support. That's respectful of kids and their capacities, but it's also at the same time supportive in a much more substantive way than the reward or punishment approach or empty good job kinds of things.
Thanks so much to all of you for coming tonight. Most of all, thank you, Alfie Cohn.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was education and parenting expert Alfie Cohn. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, and Maya Finley. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature Harvard professor of mind and psychology, Steven Pinker. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.